Welcome to the P3 Pilates Progressions Program, brought to you by Personalized Pilates. If you would like more information about the whole P3 program, please visit www.personalizedpilates.com. I'm Katrina Foe, your host for tonight. I'm a second-generation Pilates master teacher trainer, and I'm here to answer all your Pilates and anatomy questions so that you can take your Pilates teaching to the next level.
Hello. Tonight we've got some great questions. I am going to just jump right into things. You guys have been sending in some good ones, so I'm going to just read the first one for you. Remember, if you want to send them in, you can go ahead and email to me directly, Katrina@personalizedpilates.com, or you can go ahead and call in. Tonight is a live show, and the number is 347-838-9945. But I know you instructors a lot of times are busy and are listening to this later on iTunes and such. So anyways, send them in, and then it's anonymous too, and you don't have to worry about asking a stupid question. Although, I just want to remind you there's no stupid questions. So tonight, we've got a whole bunch of random things, not quite as a theme, but lots of really great questions tonight. So a lot of them are specific client-oriented, but I want to make sure that it's wide enough for anyone, you know, so I'm going to kind of open up the topic and talk about the whole other implications to similar client situations, because I think a lot of times, even if you have a specific client question, it can be really applicable to a lot of different situations and brings up good points. So on that note, we have a client that someone wrote about. She wrote, I have a new client in my reformer class that fell off a roof eons ago and broke a bone in his foot. He also injured his right hip, but that was only diagnosed a couple years ago. The diagnosis was explained to me like this, quote, they just said it's messed up in there, parentheses hip. He's in his 70s and has a very rigid through the spine. When he stands, his right shoulder is quite a bit lower than his left. He's supposed to have a hip replacement and is doing Pilates twice a week to get ready for surgery. I have to admit, I had a mini panic attack because I can't figure out why his right shoulder is so much lower. What does it have to do with the hip injury? We're working on articulation, and the other teacher is working on a lot of clam-type exercises and single leg side lying on the reformer. At this, quote, studio, they're only reformers. I'd appreciate your helping me think through this, though. I'm attaching some pictures here, too. They'll be in following emails. And she sent a picture of him standing facing the front and from the back and stuff, which was very nice. He looks like a lovely client. So here's some thoughts. First off, probably a class may not be the best idea because it sounds like he's got a lot of issues. But again, it depends on the class and depends on him, because I am not going to be the self-righteous person that says classes are perfect, because they're not. They're never perfect. They're not perfectly leveled, and that's how it is. But just random thoughts. So my second thought is that the shoulder, there is quite a discrepancy, like she mentioned, between the two shoulders and the height. The shoulders may not have anything to do with hip injury at all. It could be coming from something else. Now, I say that knowing full well that the hips and the foot and the shoulder are all linked together. So, of course, on some level, they are connected. But it may not be like a causal effect like maybe you're implying or assuming, or at least it comes across in the email as you're implying or assuming that because of the hip, the shoulder is doing this. It's not always quite that straightforward. He could carry a very heavy bag on that side or have some kind of a job that requires him to do something, you know, that throws him off, or, you know, something. He could have had another injury that maybe he forgot to tell you about. I mean, who knows? I'm just making up things. But there's a lot of things that could happen, especially, not to be rude, but when somebody's 70, there's a lot of life experience that's gone on. And most of the time, they're not even going to remember all the injuries and things that have happened to them that to tell you all of them. Okay, so just keep that in mind. Okay, so anytime you have a client that's got these kind of issues, what you want to do is really take a step back, and instead of just throwing, hip exercises in general at the person, meaning clam exercises, sideline leg stuff, whatever, things that are for the hip in general, you want to be really careful and specific about what you're doing. And this is one of the other reasons why I said it's kind of tricky for him to be in a class right now, because it sounds like it's not crystal clear in your head what's going on. Sometimes with clients like this, it's good to encourage them to maybe take a series of private so that you can figure out what's going on in their body more specifically, so you can personalize things, and then maybe they go into a class because you'll know better what would work for them and what wouldn't. Sometimes budgets won't allow that. Sometimes the client doesn't want that, and so you have to work within what you have. And then there's going to be other dynamics, like how big is the class? Is the class a whole bunch of 20-year-old girls and stuff, where you're a little more handcuffed with how you structure it and stuff. So what I would do is, first off, be looking at where his imbalances are, and secondly, look at what kind of a hip replacement he's having. Okay, so I'll start with the first section, what kind of imbalances he has. So this is a huge thing, because a lot of times instructors are like, oh, you got hip problems, we'll do hip exercises, and they just pull a whole bunch of things that are in general good for their hips. Now, while I think anatomy is incredibly important, I do not think that this requires a complete understanding of every single name of every muscle and the origins and the insertions and all that kind of stuff. We can just talk in general without even labeling them if we want to. And I go over this kind of in the Seeing the Bones lecture about looking at the movements and focusing on the movements. And the names of the muscles, I mean, they don't know if you know their names. They're going to respond accordingly based on the movement. So what you want to do is, when he's moving, look for, does he have a hard time with hip flexion or hip extension, abduction, adduction, internal, external rotation. Look for limitations where he doesn't have the movement, and look for weaknesses, okay? And those are the areas you want to focus on. So if he's going through a hip replacement or just wanting to be healthy, either way, you want to minimize those imbalances as much as possible. So once you can identify them, and that it may take several times, especially if you're working within the class setting, because you've got so much going on. You're not able to tailor the lesson plan maybe as much as you would like, because there's other people, and you're watching other people and cueing other people. And let's just face it, teaching a group of people is way harder than teaching one person. So you're a little restricted there. So just give yourself some grace, and it might take a little longer to figure it out. But with that, look for those imbalances, and look for them in the hips specifically, but look for them everywhere, because, like you mentioned, and I think you're already on this track by what you said, but when he had the foot problem, he probably tended to compensate when it was broken and stuff, which means one side might be weaker and one side might be stronger in his foot and in his leg in general, and therefore causing, quote, messed up hips. And the hips, again, they could be hiked, they could be rotated, they could be just imbalanced, with the muscles. It could be lordotic, kyphotic, all this kind of, anterior, posterior tilt with, some lordotic stuff and things. A whole bunch of different things could be going on there with the pelvis, and so you want to clearly identify which muscles are imbalanced there, but then also look at the rest of the body. And I think you're already on this line, because you're saying he's very rigid through the spine, so you've already identified that. So that's definitely an imbalance that you want to work on in terms of flexibility and just having control and articulation, able to distinguish between each one, so that fine motor control of the spinal muscles and such, and just having that finesse and detail strength to be able to control that. So I think you're on that track. Now, what does this have to do with his shoulder? Well, if his shoulder's not hurting, it's not the first necessary area of concern. And just because it is glaringly obvious and looks disturbing to you, it doesn't mean it's necessarily the problem area that you need to work on. I would focus on the squeaky wheel, so to speak, and focus on the imbalances. Now, if he can't lift that arm up over his head or something, then to me that signals there's a problem, and that's where I would be looking. If he's got a very, very tight neck and can't turn his head, you know, something's going on in his shoulder neck complex, that's a problem. You know, if he's got great functionality, you know, I'm not really concerned with the different heights. It's just an indicator that there probably is an imbalance, which you then want to identify. So when he does shoulder work, you know, look for the same things that you looked for in the hip. Does he have full range of motion? Are there any restrictions? Are there any weaknesses? And again, you don't have to identify which muscles. You want to look for which movements. And that's going to help you identify a lot clearer and quicker to figure out what you need to work on. So, again, it's really nice, and it makes you sound very smart and professional to be able to say, well, your serratus anterior is not causing your shoulder blade to upwardly rotate. But honestly, like I've said in the program all along, I don't think you should be talking like that to your clients. I think it comes off as pompous, and while they may think you're very educated at the beginning, the results speak for themselves. And if you help them to really understand their body, it's going to go a lot farther than if you're just talking down to them and making yourself sound good. So that was a little side buddy trail. So I talk like that to you guys because, you know, you guys are more peers and you need to understand this and want to understand this and you speak my language, so to speak. So when you're looking for the shoulder motions, look for those things. So you're looking for the imbalances, say which motions can he not do? Which ones are either he's too tight in or he's too weak in? And then work on those. So you can translate it directly from what you see to what you do without having to go through the labeling process, which saves you a lot of brain power and a lot of frustration and really will use your skills more directly to help the client. Okay, so I can't tell you how strongly I want to encourage this. Don't get hung up on which muscle is doing it. Okay? I'll say again, don't get hung up on which muscle is doing it or not doing it or whatever. You don't have to label the muscles. Nobody's quizzing you unless you're taking the PMA test. And it, quite frankly, doesn't matter. Look for the patterns of movement, and then you can transfer that to the patterns, same patterns of movement in the exercises that you want to work on with him. So, for example, I'm just making stuff up right now, but say with his legs, you notice that when he does say the frog on the feet and straps, his knees open like 4 inches. Okay, so obviously he's a little tight, you know, in the external hip rotation. He doesn't have much range of motion there. And so, you know, first off, clarify and make sure he knows what you want. And, you know, say, can you open your knees a little more? Maybe put your hands on the outside of his knees and say, press into my hands, or just so you're sure that he's not just not getting what you're saying. And then when you're sure, he's like, no, that doesn't go any farther, sorry. Then you'll want to think, okay, what other exercises are going to work that? So, again, I'm just picking things up out of the top of my head. My favorite is like the frog lying flat on the chair. And you mentioned you only have reformers, so a great way to do that, you could do tons of different modifications or variations, however you want to look at it, depending on how it turns out. One of my favorite, if you do it on the mat, you put a magic circle standing upright on edge under the feet. And so it's like the circle is your pedal, and you get the same angle. It's a little bit tipsier, so you might want to just keep your hand on the circle just so it doesn't fly out while they get used to it, and they're just going straight up and down. Again, he's trying to press his legs open as much as possible, and even if they don't move, it's still getting the work and the stretch in there eccentrically, and that's what you're looking for. So that's just an example. Again, a clam exercise might be good for that because it's working on the external rotation. Again, I say it might be because a lot of times that's taught wrong where the hips are moving all over the place and they're not actually getting any external rotation at all. But, of course, I'm assuming that you guys would never do that. So hopefully that gives you some insight with this client. Do not get hung up on the names and don't necessarily worry about figuring out why the shoulder is like that. Look for the imbalances. And what I have seen time and time again is that when you work on the imbalances, it just magically clears itself up. Okay? So hopefully that'll help. And I look forward to hearing as he progresses how his shoulder imbalances present themselves to you. And I think you'll start to see more of a connection as you work some of those imbalances out. Okay, so part two for the hip replacement. The hip replacement thing is really interesting, and I know you're not from the U.S., so this might be different down there, but I'm guessing in Australia they have the same procedures, but there's two ways they can do the hip replacement that I know of. There might be new ones that I don't know of, but they can either go in posteriorly from the back of the hip, and that's where they make their cuts and they, you know, shave off the bones and put everything back together, or they can go in anteriorly from the front of the hip and do the same thing. Now, the reason this makes a huge difference is that the direction that they go through, those muscles are going to get cut, and that's the area that's going to have all the scar tissue, and that's going to determine the contraindications. So you really, if you have somebody that's had a hip replacement, you must know which direction they went in from, because they have totally different contraindications of what you should avoid doing with them or, you know, be careful with and stuff. So, for example, if they go in posteriorly, you're not supposed to, post-surgery and healing and all, have their leg come up in hip flexion more than 90 degrees. They're not supposed to cross the midline of their body with that leg. And, you know, such, because what's happening is that those motions will possibly, because of the weakened area where the incisions were and, you know, depending on how thick the scar tissue is and stuff, it could pop out of socket out that back way and dislocate. Okay, so on the opposite side, going anteriorly, you don't want to extend the leg too much and things like that because it could pop out forward. So they're completely opposite. Now, if it was a perfect world, in my opinion, I have a big disclaimer there, right? The doctor that was deciding what to do with this person when they go in and decide they're going to do a hip replacement would analyze their muscle imbalances and determine which direction would be best for that person based on their personal limitations and imbalances. That would make sense, right? So, for example, my dad, he was told like a decade ago that he, I think it was probably 2 decades ago, that he needed hip replacements, and he's just a little stubborn and has refused to do it. But at that time, I started studying up on hip replacements and how it worked, and I told him, you know, listen, for you, because he's incredibly tight in, like, his hip flexor area and the internal rotation's, like, non-existent and all this stuff, like, I thought, you know, probably going in from the front was going to be better for him than going in from the back and stuff. But, again, when he goes in, he picks his surgeon based on insurance and who's in his plan or, you know, the recommendation of his friend or, you know, who the best surgeon is in the area. And each surgeon has their favorite method, the one that they like. It has nothing to do with the client and what is best for the client. Okay, so I want to impress that upon you as a Pilates instructor because I am confident in saying that that's not how you would do it if you were a surgeon. So at least for me, when I found this out, it was kind of like, well, why in the world would they do it that way? That doesn't make any sense. That can't be right. But unfortunately, it is. And so as a Pilates instructor, you're probably not going to change the system. If it's somebody like your dad, you can do the research and figure out which one would be better for them and encourage them to get a surgeon that will do that direction. But with a client, you know, probably you don't have that kind of relationship and you don't want to tread and be pushy like that. And so, you know, you're going to have to work within whatever they decide. You might want to educate them and let them know what you see. But again, that depends on your relationship with them and such. So what I would do in this case, I say all that for a point, is I would find out which direction he's going to have the hip replacement done and have him ask the doctor. You know, he may not know. A lot of people, if he comes in saying it's just messed up in there, then he probably does not take a lot of interest in what the doctor says or trying to remember it or anything. You know, have him ask the doctor and just have him write it down so he doesn't forget. And that's going to give you some idea of what you want to focus on beforehand and what you want to focus on after, meaning what the contraindications are going to be. In case you can't decide what he's going to do, at least this would give you some information on how to work with him. So hopefully that helps you and gives you some ideas where to go with him. Don't have a mini panic attack because I don't think most of us would figure out why his right shoulder is so much lower by watching him move one time either. And again, sometimes these things take a while. Sometimes we never know why. It just happens. And there's a lot of factors that he may not be aware of that are contributing. There might be emotional factors. Like, for example, I know there's a lot of women that have really kyphotic body postures, and it's not anything structural or anything. It's psychological. Maybe they develop their breasts early, and they're embarrassed. Or, you know, maybe they're just really large, and they're embarrassed. Or, you know, maybe they were molested or something, and so they're trying to kind of hide and protect themselves. So there's a lot of issues and stuff, and that has nothing to do with the shoulder, but just to give you some extreme examples of how it maybe has nothing to do with anything physically, it can be something completely different that would be very difficult for you to figure out from this context. So hopefully that gives you some ideas and thoughts, and let me know what you think about that and how it helps you next time you see him. Okay, next question here. Sure. Good morning. I'm loving the P3 podcast, and I love the P3 lectures. Well, I'm glad. I'm incredibly impressed and thankful for the P3 program. Thanks to Katrina and Larry for doing such a good job with it. I just listened to the history lecture. Why is Jay Grimes not listed as an elder? On Vintage Pilates website, he says he worked with Joe and Clara. You're so knowledgeable that I truly trust your informational sources. Thanks. Okay, so this is a great, great question. First off, I'm so glad you're loving the program. I love getting feedback, and especially positive feedback, knowing what you like and such. Okay, so I didn't include Jay Grimes as an elder because there's some controversy as to whether he qualifies or not. Usually only the, quote, classical / Ramana people really observe him as that. From my research, it's my understanding that he did definitely work with Joe and Clara, but that he wasn't necessarily trained as a teacher by them, more just he was trained by them. Of course, I could totally be wrong by this. I don't know him personally, and everything, you know, I've read is hearsay. I have never met him. I haven't worked with him, so this is not necessarily the most accurate information. There is a subtle difference there, but it is significant. There's actually many people that worked with Joe and Clara but weren't trained by them to be teachers, and there's a lot of people that were teachers that I didn't mention because they've, you know, long since passed away and such. So there's other people like Bruce King and Bob Seed and things that, you know, were great teachers, but they're not as well known. They passed away a longer time ago and such. The ones that I chose to mention in the history lecture were either still alive today. So there's only two of those at the time of this recording, Mary and Lolita, that people that have died recently, so I would qualify Ramana and Ron and Kathy in there, or people that have had significant impact either to the Pilates world in general, so like Ramana and Eve, or to training that I have had specifically, so Eve, Carola, Lolita, which would greatly affect the training philosophy that you will have by going through P3. So that's kind of the way I picked that. I mean, I had to have a line there at some point. This doesn't mean that Jay is not a great teacher or is any less significant of a historical figure. I just had to draw the line somewhere. The term elder was actually coined by the Pilates Method Alliance in an effort to recognize the original, I quote, original teachers and delineate some level of closeness to Joe and the original work. This is debated, and other people would consider some people elders that the PMA doesn't and stuff, but that's where I'm getting the term elder from, and I'm going by their definition. Since the diverse group of trainings represented by the PMA did not choose to include him. I just went ahead and sided with them because, again, I don't know all the information. I don't know him personally. Most of the people that were actually have been alive recently, so Mary, Lolita, Ron, Kathy, I've actually taken classes with them and have worked with them personally. I have not worked with Romana. I wasn't blessed enough to do that. And Eve passed away a long time before I was around, but she trained a lot of people that I was trained by. So there's that influence there. On a side note, this is an easy way also to determine someone's philosophy. So if they're talking about Jay, this is just, you know, jumping to conclusions. Chances are they are probably heavily influenced by classical Romana-style philosophy. Again, it's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's always good to know what slant people have when you're talking to them and taking information in from them. I think that's important in any context, whether it's Pilates or the news or whatever. You want to know where that person's coming from and why they're saying, you know, what made them who they are, kind of thing. So when you're thinking about, okay, I'm talking to somebody or learning from somebody that is classical and, you know, trained by Romana, you need to know that they believe that you always have to do all the exercises in the same order. You always have to do them the way that they were taught, Romana's way. You can't really modify and do all this stuff. I mean, there's a lot of ways that they probably differ than what I have been trained in and what I tend to teach and what you're learning in the P3 program, which, again, I love. Some of my favorite teachers are classically trained and are Romana trained, and I have no problem with that. I've taken with a lot with Tone and Michael, and I absolutely adore them, and they were Romana's teacher trainers for a long time. So I'm not against that in any way. It's just good to know who they are and how they were trained so that you know maybe why they're teaching you things the way they're teaching it to you, okay? I also think it's important to note that there's a huge difference in how the elders all perceive Joe's teachings to have been. Okay, so what does this mean? Well, he did lots of different things for different people. He evolved. He was interpreted by people differently, lots of things. So, for example, you know, I mentioned I've taken lessons from all these different elders and classes and workshops, and you know, some of them do neutral pelvis, some of them do flat back, and that's very different, but I don't know. I just wonder, did Joe maybe, I mean, because he didn't articulate why you do this or that and get into the anatomy and stuff like we do now. I mean, did he just know that that was better for this person and this is better for that person because this person is really lordotic and they needed to do it like this? You know, I don't know. We unfortunately can't ask him because he's gone now, but, you know, they don't all agree on the same thing, and I think that's very interesting to think about. The big takeaway is that you want to work with people that are thoroughly trained and knowledgeable about Joe and what he did, as well as about anatomy and such. And there's tons of people out there like that. And you want to have a good understanding that what you actually do with the clients depends on a lot of many, many different factors that are individual to that person. So age, emotional status, physical limitations, psychological understanding, your own limitations as a teacher, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot that goes into how and why you do what you do when you're teaching. So my goal in the history section was just to give you guys as much information as needed to get the big picture view of Joe and why, how he did his work. I think it should help you put the whole thing into context of the bigger picture, especially when you start to delve out into the Pilates world and you see all this diversity and arguing on, you know, how the exercises are supposed to be done and everything. When you understand who Joe was and how he taught, it's going to help you understand how you want to be as a teacher, what you want to impart to people. So I would just hate for somebody that goes to the P3 to not know that Joe had a wife named Clara and that who also was a teacher or something like that. And honestly, there's a lot of teachers out there that don't know that Pilates is someone's last name. I'm not even joking. So that's my main thing. I put in a lot of extra little juicy tidbits in there just because I think it's interesting. And Lolita is very, very interesting. She always was telling us more and more tidbits about him, and she's done tons of research. I mean, to going back to Germany, she's been back to Mönchengladbach so many times and researched things and is very fascinated with Joe's life and everything. So I've gotten a lot more dirt, if you will, than maybe the average person. I think it's fun to pass that on because, I think it's really interesting and good to know more about him since we are trying to emulate him. Okay, next question. This is not a fun one. Sorry. I have a client who is a doctor. She does a duet with a nurse friend of hers, and they are good together. Same level of fitness. The doctor lady came in the other day and said she just had a bone scan and has osteopenia. So the next lesson, I did not have her do any flexion, but I let the nurse lady do it. Of course, she questioned me, and I told her that was because of the osteopenia and basically said that her spine doesn't need any more flexion and that we want to stay on the safe side, etc. She told me she still wanted to do some flexion because it was just osteopenia and not osteoporosis. I didn't say anything and moved on to something else because I didn't know how to, quote, argue with the doctor. What are your suggestions? Oh, so awkward. The position that she puts you in is so not fair. But here's the thing. You are the expert in your field. This is not her field. I cannot tell you how many times I have worked with clients that I've talked to them about osteoporosis, and they've gone back to their doctor, and their doctor literally didn't know what the contraindications for were. They just knew the drugs to prescribe. They never talked to the person about, okay, you know, when you bend over and touch your, you know, tie your shoelaces, that is probably going to possibly break your back. You know, they don't explain to them things like what is flexion and how to avoid it and such. So you've got to just keep that in mind when you're dealing with this. On the other hand, this is your client. This is a customer service industry. You need to be respectful and make sure whether they're a doctor or not has, I mean, nothing to do with it. You want to make sure that you handle it with love and grace, okay? So don't argue with them. But you need to make sure that you are going to be able to properly kick their butt without having them miss the flexion. Okay, now, this is the challenge with osteoporosis, osteopenia as such. What you said to her about flexion is not what her body needs is dead on, and wanting to stay on the safe side, dead on. You also have to remember that when you're telling somebody this, it's like officially writing that they're old on their forehead. Okay, because osteoporosis is like an old lady disease. People associate it with little 70-year-old ladies with the humpback and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so you start telling them that they can't do things in here, and they're like, yeah, I can. And they're going to get really riled up because this is not like when somebody's pregnant and you're telling them they can't do stuff. You know, at that point, it's for the safety of the baby. And of course, who doesn't want to do something that's going to protect the baby and stuff? And it's temporary. Guess what? You know, 9 months later, you get to do it again. It's no big deal. But this is like, okay, well, for the rest of your life. So just tread lightly on that, especially with women who, again, predominantly the people that are coming with osteoporosis tend to be women. It's just a kind of part of the disease. It's more prevalent in women. So they tend to be a little more susceptible and sensitive to being called old. So just know that that's a huge factor. We had a client once who I don't think our instructor handled it poorly at all, but she got very, very riled up. And to the point where she went in and was like wanting to, she said, well, can I get my doctor to sign off on it? And we're like, no, because we're still not comfortable with it. And she's like, well, can I have my lawyer make up a contract that you and I can sign saying that I release you from any liability? I'm like, no, because I just don't want to hurt you, and I fully believe that it's just not what's good for your body. So the bottom line is you have been trained thoroughly to understand and know what's best for that person's body by working on their muscle imbalances, understanding the contraindications, and they are paying you good money, a lot of money, for that expertise to decide what you need. They're not just paying you to sit, you know, do more, five more, you know, work harder. You know, they're paying for your expertise of what is best for them. And so it's very important that you build value in that and explain what you're doing and why they need it. So as you're going through, you're going to need to focus very heavily on those value-adding statements. So go back to that lecture, reread it, and listen to it over and over again. And so you're going to need to focus on value-adding statements about why you're deciding what she needs to do. So point out where her imbalances are and point out the exercises that you're doing for those things and how those are what she needs. Okay, that's going to build value in your expertise and your authority in her eyes. And it's going to help her learn that you are not just, you know, taking her through kind of a fitness thing. You are really, you have a plan. You have a reason of why you're doing what you're doing. The other thing is to really, like I mentioned, alluded to before, you need to kick her butt, okay? So she needs to know that just because she has osteoporosis, or osteopenia rather, that she's still going to get a good ab workout, okay? So you've got to go through and make sure that you know how to kick her butt and make sure that she feels it. So review what her goals are and make sure you accomplish them. Even if it's at the detriment of her friend for a time being, not saying like you're going to hurt her friend at all, but if you're prioritizing the doctor lady and her priorities and her goals and really focusing on her and her education and value-adding statements, that's going to be what you need to do for a while. This is such a hard situation because I would have a hard time compromising and letting her do the flexion. If you're going to, just be very, very careful. Don't do anything with loaded flexion. That would be the worst you could do. And again, I really, truly believe in my heart that if you focus on the things she can do that are hard, she will not care. Okay, and that's usually where most instructors fail. They get freaked out like they're working with a little glass statue all of a sudden. They're just going to shatter any second. And they just baby them and they do all this easy neutral spine stuff. And they really aren't challenging the osteoperson, especially in a situation where it's a group class or a duet. The tendency is to just, okay, well, you stretch for a second while we do the series of five because you're not allowed to do it. That just makes someone feel like a gimp, you know, and they're not getting as much of a workout and stuff. So make sure that you kick her butt and she's your priority and that she can trust that you have her best interest at heart. Okay, now all this to say, even if you do a fabulous job of that, you may still have hurt her ego enough to the point where you may need to let her go as a client. And I want to validate that this does happen every once in a while. I think we've had it happen two or three times in the history of our studio where the osteoporosis, osteopenia thing is a big enough deal that the client, and we will not compromise on it, that they will leave. And you have to be okay with losing a client on that, keeping your standards and knowing that you are not hurting that person, okay? Don't be hurting for the money and compromising on it because it's going to be a slippery slope after that. So hopefully that won't have to happen. And you can handle the situation well and with grace, and it won't be an issue. Okay, need a little water there. Ah, so many questions. I love it. Okay, so these are shorter questions. All right, so next question. I have been watching some Pilates videos on Pilatesology. One of the instructors mentions the three diamonds with regards to the leg circles at the part where you're squeezing the legs to bring them all the way back together. When the legs are squeezed, there's three triangles. I am not understanding this. Is one of the triangles the sits bones and the pubic bone? Well, you know what? I have no idea. I'll be the first one to tell you. The Pilatesology site tends to be, from my understanding, all Ramana-based instructors, which is fine. Again, like I mentioned earlier with the other question, I think, you know, classical Ramana people are awesome too. But this is really, it might just be an image that is very popular in those circles and they all kind of know what they're talking about and maybe we don't. This goes back to one of our lectures when I was talking about imagery. And it's very, very important that you explain the whole image. So in my opinion, I don't know the teacher, so this isn't like a personal attack, but it's very, very common, especially as a teacher, once you've used this image a lot, to kind of shorthand it, you know, and just kind of refer to abstract things that maybe your client doesn't know. And you'll hear this all the time in Pilates lessons. You've got to make sure you give them the whole image and that they understand what you're saying. Otherwise, the imagery, not enhancing the lesson, is hindering. And the key thing in this is that I have never, in all the times that I'm observing people teach, and I've done a lot of that in the teacher training stuff, I've never had a client say, "What are you talking about?" and like stop and interrupt them when an image doesn't make sense. So usually what happens when an image doesn't make sense, they think they're stupid or they just dismiss it. And they're not blaming you, which is really where the case lies. So I'm going to go out on a limb and say this really is just a matter of they didn't explain their imagery properly and thoroughly, probably because it's something that people take for granted in that kind of group. So sorry, I don't have anything better. From what you've explained, I would guess the sits bones and the pubic bone. But if you're saying there's three triangles, I got no idea where the other two are. So I'm sorry about that. Maybe somebody else knows what that image relates to, and they can email me, and I can mention on a later show. If you know, please let me know, and so I can pass it on to this sweet instructor. Okay, next one. I have clients that are doing a duet. They're extreme beginners. They've only come to me a few times, but I notice one of them, parentheses, the less athletic, flexible one, competes with her friend. Then she just peters out and won't really do the exercise. She's just there because someone said Pilates would be good for her, but she doesn't believe it herself. I try to laugh it off, but it's really frustrating. I need a mantra to repeat in my head to keep my reaction from showing up on my face. Any ideas? I love it. You want like a catechism question for this. I don't know that I've got a really great line for you, but I have had a client that I remember like this. She actually used to do a trio. Oh, she drove me crazy. She would just kind of like give herself all these, you know, excuses and stuff. And the bottom line was, I think, you know, you have to remember that there's some, you know, they feel bad if they can't keep up. And so it's easier to quit than to not win, so to speak. So I think this goes back to the value-adding statements again. So you can listen to the lecture along with the other person. The value-adding statements are really important. So when this client is driving you insane, just remember her feelings are probably hurt, okay? She probably doesn't feel like she's as good a person because she's not doing it as well. A lot of people have it ground into their head that, you know, you are, you know, your performance. And so if she doesn't do as well, she feels bad. So just keep reminding her, even before she peters out and before she has a bad attitude, as often as you can between exercises, things like, this is not a competition. I want you to focus on yourself, and this is going to be different today than it was yesterday or last week or whatever. The more they get that ingrained into their head, the more she's going to free herself up. So anything you can say along those lines, and say it like literally like 10 different ways every single lesson. Other things you're going to want to repeat, that it's not about how much she does, it's about how much effort and focus she puts into it. And along those lines, the same thing, kind of, you're only going to get out of it what you put into it. And you can even explain to them, especially if you get an exercise where you have a little more talking time, you know, you can explain to them, you know, I have duets all the time, and one person gets great results, one person gets no results. They're doing the exact same workout. What is the deal? And it's just a matter of one person really gives it all they have and is really focused mentally and trying to, you know, take all the corrections in, and one person is just slopping through it. Again, they both checked off all the exercises, but it is a completely different experience internally in their body, and therefore the results are going to be very, very different. You know, the more you can express that to them and help them educate themselves about that, the better it is, because remember, you are going against everything that society says. Society tells you if you do the work, you've checked it off, you will get the results. It doesn't say you have to do it with mental focus and you have to pay attention or you know, you have to give it your all. It's just check it off your list. You were in the Pilates studio for an hour, so you get X amount of calories burned, right? No, totally doesn't work like that. And you're not going to retrain your muscle patterns if you're not focusing on retraining your muscle patterns. I mean, it's a mental thing. So this is a very, very different paradigm from traditional fitness. And the longer that you've been with us with the P3 program and in Pilates and, you know, getting it, the deeper you'll get it. I tell another little personal story. My mom, love her to death, she first started coming to me when I was first started to teach, and she so had no idea. She just thought it was a workout, it was a social time to spend with her daughter, and oh, she was like the worst client because she wanted to talk the whole time and she wanted to, you know, just socialize, and it was kind of fun. But then, you know, she wasn't getting results. Shocking. Well, she was doing other exercise for a while and things, and then she came back to it, and it was amazing the difference because she started to understand it at a whole nother level. And she was like, what was I even doing before? I'm like, I know. But, you know, she wasn't ready for it. And it took a long time. I would say probably 5 to 8 years until she really understood that there's a whole nother level of Pilates. And, you know, I was explaining that to her. So sometimes people mentally and emotionally aren't ready to do the work. And that's, you know, your responsibility only goes so far. You can educate them and explain it to them, as I did with my mom. And they can kind of nod and say, yeah, 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 but not really connect and apply that to themselves and not get it. And that's where your responsibility ends. You can give them, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. But I have found that if people stick with it, eventually they do get it. And that's when things start lighting up and they start getting so excited and they start seeing the profound changes. And that's where it really gets good. So I will say that she's made a lot of progress. She doesn't chit-chat nearly as much, although she's still somewhat distractible. I think it's because there's pictures of my kids in the studio, which are her grandkids, you know, so she's a little distracted by that, but that's a separate issue. Okay, so I want to validate your frustration. Trying to laugh it off is good. The more value-adding statements you can add, the better. That is going to be the best case scenario. Also, you might want to play with this, and this might not work depending on the clients, but tailoring it to things and the way you teach it so that they will peter out more at the same time might help so that her ego is not hurt too much. You can play with that. And again, that's going to be different on different exercises and different people depending on how where their strengths and weaknesses are. Otherwise, I'd try to give you an example of that. But try to really focus on the good things, encourage her, catch her in the positive, you know, so that she gets as much praise as her friend. That can be a really big thing. If she just it feels like it's a competition and she's losing, she may get frustrated, and that's the person that's going to quit. So make sure that your encouragement is even and your corrections are evenly dispersed, meaning so that you're not always picking on one and encouraging the other. And that I would go to any duet, trio, group class, whatever, you want to make sure because, you know, some people like being picked on, you know, they're ex-ballerinas and they get that that's a good thing, but a lot of people don't like that or, you know, it needs to be fairly even, even if they are having more trouble. That's okay. So another random side note there. Okay, it looks like I have time for another question. So we'll throw another one out there. Oh, here's another fun one. We got some great customer service questions, client handling things today. I have a client that's been coming to me for about a year, twice a week. She also visits the chiropractor once a week as she has sciatic pain down her right side and is kyphotic. Her posture has improved immensely, but her flexibility in her hamstrings and lower back is not improving. She can't touch her toes anymore. She kind of could when I first saw her, and she's not allowed to do any feet and straps because she can't straighten her legs. When she's doing hamstring one in the chair, she can barely reach the pedal, and the movement comes only from her thoracic area where she's kyphotic. Her pelvis does not tilt at all. It's straight up and down and will not move no matter what she does. I don't do stomach massage because it pulls her low back and her legs don't move when she tries to push out. She can't do elephant even though I've tried to adjust the foot bar, feet, etc. She just can't reach the foot bar and keep her legs straight. She doesn't do kneeling splits but can do eased lunge. We do reverse splits and side splits. She can't go out that far before it pulls her on her right butt cheek. When we would do mermaid or side sit-ups, she had a tendency to roll back on her right butt cheek, but we fixed that now, and there's no pain on her right low back slash butt when she comes up. I just feel that after a year, twice a week, she should be able to touch her toes. I know you can't see her, but what are your thoughts? Okay, several thoughts. First off, if somebody's got things like sciatica and kyphosis and everything, and they can't touch their toes when they come in, coming in for a year twice a week totally may not be enough to all of a sudden touch their toes. Some people may never touch their toes, and that's okay. So please let that go. A lot of times when you're unraveling these muscle imbalances, things get worse before they get better. So don't freak out about that. And this doesn't sound that much worse. I'm going to give you some tips to work on with her. So first off, my question is, why is she not allowed to do feet and straps because she can't straighten her legs? Is this something that the chiropractor put on you, or is this something that you've arbitrarily said? Because, you know, if she's really tight in her hamstrings, the big thing to look and her low back, the thing is that the exercises are going to look radically different. And so as an instructor, what you want to do is really step back and have a clear picture and understanding in your mind of where is the movement supposed to take place and focus on that and let some of the other details go because they're not going to be able to do it correctly. So here's what I mean. So, for example, feet and straps. What we were trying to do is get her hips kind of loosened up and juicy in the sockets with that, while her pelvis stays still. So it's an exercise for most people in pelvic stability and differentiating the movement from the pelvis and the hips, so hip differentiation. Now, if her knees bend, yes, I would rather have them straight, but I think that that's probably an exercise that's going to be very helpful for her. Again, not seeing her in front of me, but so I would probably say, yeah, she can bend her legs. And what I would do is I would put the responsibility on her. So I'd say, Susie Jo, I want you to really keep your pelvis still. We're going to make these circles. And she's doing it, and her legs are totally bent. Say, okay, now I want you to continue this because you've got that motion. The pelvis is staying still. And see how straight you can get your legs. That right there is where the power is going to come in to help lengthen her hamstrings. If you just cut it out because she can't keep them totally straight, or if you just let them stay totally bent, either end of that spectrum is going to miss the work, in my opinion. Same thing on the elephant. So let her do the elephant and keep her legs bent, and you know, make sure she's got her head down. I would, you know, let her chest be up as much as it needs to try to keep, you know, so she's not all kyphotic and stuff. But then let her knees be bent, and every time she pulls the carriage in, tell her to lift her sits bones to the sky and feel that stretching the legs as much as she can. And that's a really qualitative cue so that you're putting the responsibility on her to be able to straighten her legs as much as she can. And that's going to look different day to day. And what that's going to do is it's going to actively engage her hamstrings in that lengthening eccentric motion, not just having to keep her legs always straight or always bent and not worry about it, but she's actively trying to straighten her legs, and that's going to change the resting length of the muscle. That's what you want. So whether or not she gets them straight really isn't the issue. It's really more about the journey as she's trying to keep them straight. Okay, so the other things that you mentioned, hamstring one in the chair and stomach massage, from what you're saying, these are totally not appropriate. I totally agree with you. These are great hamstring stretches and exercises for people with a normal range of motion. She doesn't fall in that category. So you're going to have to just wipe them out. And the things that you never would think of as being a hamstring stretch are going to become a hamstring stretch. So anytime that you can like keep a neutral spine and fold at the hip is going to be a huge helpful thing for her. And literally, well, I'll give you an example. I had this boy, I think he was like 15, and he terribly inflexible. So he wanted to make the baseball team and knew that he was like way too tight for it. And I think he had just gone through a growth spurt, and so his body hadn't quite, you know, figured out what just happened to him. But he came in. His mom had been a client for like a decade, and she brought him in to see if we could help him out. And I put him in feet and straps, and his legs wouldn't even straighten all the way, and his legs, the leg-to-floor angle was about 45 degrees. So, I mean, there is nowhere near, you know, 90 or something, which is what the kind of normal range of motion is, keeping the pelvis still. But I'll tell you what, within 6 months to a year, he was at 90 degrees, no problem. And he was like, oh, wet noodle, meaning when he first came in, I mean, his pelvis, oh, my gosh, it was a disaster. The feed and strap series, we did that all the time, just working on pelvic stabilization where the pelvis stays still and the legs move independently. And you can do that in lots of different areas. You could do that side leg. You can do that with the leg springs. You can do that all sorts of places. But just working on exercises where they can try to straighten their legs, but it doesn't really matter if they do straighten their legs. And there's a lot of exercises like that, like we mentioned the elephant, the feet and straps and things. There's also a variation of feet and straps where you can put the strap around your leg, like up by above your knee. Now, usually this is done if there's a problem with the foot or if you're really trying to take the knee joint out of it, there's a problem with the knee or something. But you could do this with her and play with it and see if she can keep her leg straight but just put the strap above her knee and stuff. Personally, I'd probably just put the strap still on her feet. But, again, it's just a variation that you can play with and stuff and think about because you know the client much better than I do. Now, in terms of the sciatic pain, okay, the sciatic pain is showing you big red warning light. There is a severe muscle imbalance going on in the pelvis. Any muscle that attaches to the pelvis is under suspicion. Okay, so you are the detective that has to figure out who is too tight, who is too weak, and work on that. And when you start to figure that out and unravel that, the pull on the pelvis is not going to be there, so the sciatic pain is going to go away, which I'm going to put a lot of money on. That's way more important to her than whether she can touch her toes. Touching your toes is usually a nice external measure, but that really doesn't matter to most people. It's really more the pain. So I would focus on that. Don't get too worried about the touching the toes, although, again, that's obviously one of her spots. So what are the opposing muscles to the hamstrings? The hamstrings extend the hip, so the hip flexors. So check her hip flexors and see how they're doing. See if they're strong. And you know, notice that imbalance. That's probably going to be a big one. With the clients that I have worked with sciatica, I have noticed, again, it can be anything, but I find the majority of them are weak adductors and too tight on the AB, outside ductors. Again, it sounds like you obviously have a big clue that it's the hip flexor, hip extensor things. I mean, even the pelvic floor can be a major pull on this sciatica stuff. So you've got to look at anything that attaches to the pelvis with a real magnifying glass and look at that. And it can be multiple things. And I think that's what makes sciatica so confusing is that it has layers. And this is the one area that I think is the trickiest to figure out. And I believe we've talked about sciatica in other shows, and if we haven't, we should. And we're definitely going to talk about it in the P3 Level 2 coming up. But it really is individual. There is not like a set here, these exercises work great for it. You know, this is the imbalance. It's very, very personal. And if you get the imbalance wrong, you will annoy it. It'll be like, you know, stick in a beehive. Which makes it, in some ways, easier to deal with. So the kyphotic stuff, it sounds like you have a good understanding of, you know, not trying to focus on flexion in the thoracic area and everything. So focus on that and just try to get that pelvis moving. Even things like pelvic clock, that is going to be a huge exercise to try to help her get the pelvis and the hip separated and to get that low back mobile. That would be an excellent homework assignment probably for her. So just some thoughts like that. Where can we work on, does the pelvis move? Does the thigh bone move? You know, all that kind of thing. And trying to get that body awareness there and get some movement and get some control there is going to be your key. Okay, so if you have follow-up questions to any of these things that we talked about tonight, please send me an email because I always love to hear from you. And that's going to be it for tonight. So have a great night, and just remember that everybody deserves to enjoy movement, and you get to help teach them how.